From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Mitt Romney and Barack Obama both said it on the campaign trail. The stakes couldn't be higher. The choice of a lifetime, of a future. Yesterday, the country chose Obama. Here was the president with jubilant supporters in Chicago last night, looking to pull it all together.
We are not as divided as our politics suggests. We're not as cynical as the pundits believe. We are greater than the sum of our individual ambitions, and we remain more than a collection of red states and blue states.
And here, Mitt Romney gracious conceding in Boston, saying, reach across the aisle.
At a time like this, we can't risk partisan bickering and political posturing. Our leaders have to reach across the aisle to do the people's work. And we citizens also have to rise to the occasion.
But the aisle, the divide, has been wide. You hear it right there in that tape. This hour On Point, a nation decided and divided. Where do we go from Election Day? You can join the conversation. Where does this vote leave us? What now? Democrats, what do you see? Republicans, what have we learned? What's the way ahead? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us now from New York is Joan Walsh, editor-at-large at Salon.com. She's the author of What's the Matter with White People? Why We Long for a Golden Age That Never Was. Joan Walsh, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks, Tom.
From Pasadena, California, Charles Kessler joins us, senior fellow at the conservative Claremont Institute, author of I Am the Change, Barack Obama and the Crisis of Liberalism. Charles Kessler, welcome. Thanks for being here today.
Thank you, Tom. It's very kind of you to invite me.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beattie. Welcome, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Joan, and Charles.
Jack, I'm going to come first to you. What have we just witnessed here, Jack?
Well, I think people have been saying it. It's the Obama one-word campaign slogan. Frankly, it sounded a little fascistic to me. Forward, avanti. You know?
Okay.
But it was forward.
I mean,
yes, forward on social matters, these gay marriage initiatives. Forward on a progressive platform that is going to, Obamacare is going to go forward. People who are today not covered in the millions will be covered. The country will gain from that, and forward on the sort of multiracial, multicultural America of the future. Emerson said that, there's the party of memory and the party of hope. The Republican Party, in this election at least, was the party of memory.
The Republican Party is party of memory. Charles Kessler in Pasadena this morning, with this result in front of us, do you buy that? Is that the way it is, or is that I don't know how you can say just about a presidential election outcome. What about that? Republican Party is party of memory.
Well, I'm not sure, first of all, that the word for what happened last night was forward. I think it might better be sideways. We're basically back at the status quo ante. I mean, we have a strongly Republican and conservative House of Representatives, and we have the same president and more or less the same Senate, a Democratic Senate, a liberal Senate, probably a little more liberal than it was before, but the same prescription for divided government. As far as the Republican Party being the party of memory, to some extent, that's, of course, understandable. The candidate himself seemed to be out of the past in a certain way, but overwhelmingly, I think what Romney represented was the Republican Party as a party of business and of the business agenda and the business class, and that I think conservatives and Republicans are going to take a hard second look at.
Joan, okay, here we've got an Obama victory. Charles Kessler says not forward but sideways, maybe. We still do have the same alignment, broadly speaking, in Washington. But after all these months and years of fighting over who would lead from the White House next, you come out with an American majority that says, not by a razor-thin margin, here's the one we want to do the job. Does that mean sideways, forward? How do you interpret it, Joan?
Oh, it's absolutely forward, Tom. There's no doubt about it. I mean, for this president to win re-election, it was a huge deal for us to elect our first African-American president. It is a much bigger deal to re-elect him based strongly on his record and with a little asterisk based strongly on the terrible campaign of his opponent, Mitt Romney, and his party. I mean, the Republican Party has to do an enormous amount of soul searching in the weeks to come. And I know that they will, and I don't know what the outcome will be. You are going to hear, and you're already hearing people saying, oh, it was Hurricane Sandy, it stopped Mitt's momentum. Or you're hearing people say, as Charles does, he was a candidate of business, and maybe that's not a good idea. You're going to hear Tea Party people say, he was shoved on us, he was the establishment, he was never right wing enough. But I just want to single out one thing that I think both represents the party's backwardness and its problems, was that Mitt Romney came out against the DREAM Act. I don't know how we ever solve our immigration problems and our cultural and multiracial cohesion problems without a simple solution like the DREAM Act. I don't know how you can look at those young people who are working in school and say, we're going to pull the plug on you, we're going to hope that you self-deport. It's the simplest bipartisan compromise idea that 10 years ago could have become consensus. And in this Republican Party, it was just a bridge too far. And that's demographic suicide for them, but it's also really tragic, and it's bad for the country.
Let's listen to how the two contenders were summing it up last night, early this morning, really. President Obama saying that elections matter, that democracy in a country of 300 million can be noisy, messy, complicated. Well, to say the least, here's the president.
When we make big decisions as a country, it necessarily stirs passions, stirs up controversy. That won't change after tonight, and it shouldn't. These arguments we have are a mark of our liberty. And we can never forget that as we speak, people in distant nations are risking their lives right now just for a chance to argue about the issues that matter, the chance to cast their ballots like we did today.
People in distant lands fighting for the chance to argue. But Charles Kessler, does there come a point at which this division becomes itself, this argument becomes itself a threat to this republic? Are we there?
No, we're not there. I think, I mean, that was one of President Obama's most eloquent speeches in a long time. And it was I'm sure for his supporters, refreshing to hear him sound those themes, which were mostly old themes of his rhetoric, but very well expressed. But I don't think that stalemate so often in our politics is there are deep differences of principle between the two parties. And you'll see this again because we're going to have the same correlation of forces working in the divided houses of the legislature this time, and you can't wish away those differences of principle. You can sometimes force a compromise, and I think there will be compromises on some of the tax questions and to some extent on the budget questions, because the market is going to force a compromise on Republicans and to some extent, to a lesser extent probably, on Democrats as well. But it's harder to compromise on something like Obamacare, which represents a vision of government's place in our life and an understanding of new kinds of socioeconomic rights that government is supposed to vindicate. And those things are extremely controversial. They are in many ways athwart a lot of the American political tradition and certainly the earlier constitutional understanding of our politics. And it is just difficult to compromise on those. One party has eventually, I think, to prevail.
Jack, I mean, here you are. You pluck forward as the word straight off the bumper sticker to sort of characterize the voters' message yesterday, and we're right back talking about the same division as before the election. I mean, is there a point at which, Jack, some of this gets behind us? Does an election mean nothing in working out this deep division that Charles Kessler points to? Does it just clarify and emphasize it?
For the time being, but let's look ahead. First of all, this was a victory worth having. There will be a recovery. the president will get the credit for it. The Democrats will get the credit for it. Second, you know, Harry Hopkins, FDR's invaluable aide, there's an apocryphal quotation attributed to him. And this is really the formula, I think I'm probably agreeing with Charles, that the Democrats have followed to success. Tax and tax, spend and spend, elect and elect. You know, it was tax and tax. That's the formula that won in the upper Midwest. White working class voters went, you know, they didn't go by a majority, but they went much more strongly for the president there. Why? Government did something for them. Tax and tax, spend and spend, elect and elect. And now, in this next 4 years, we're going to have at least 15 million people are going to be covered under Medicaid who aren't now and who won't have to pay a dime for it. The other 15 or 20 million will have to pay something under Obamacare. Tax and tax, spend. That's how you build a majority. That's how you build an enduring majority.
What about fiscal viability?
Well, yes, but one of the sort of miracles of Obamacare, if you will, is that the congressional budget office says it'll actually save money because of the way the efficiencies and who knows, but that's at least the official scoring on it.
Joan, is the miracle before us here? Tax, spend, elect, and just keep doing that.
Well, I don't, you know, sure, Jack's right, but it sounds more cynical than it is. I think the idea of government is for us to come together and do things together that we couldn't do separately. And it turns out that health insurance and health care is one of those things. And I find it really amazing and a great signal of how far to the right this whole conversation has shifted, Tom. We have to remember that Obamacare is Romney care, and much of it came from the Heritage Foundation. This is an example of the kind of compromise, like I was talking about the DREAM Act a little while ago. This is the kind of compromise that should have been a no-brainer, where Democrats took a Republican idea and said, hey, you know what? They're right. Maybe we shouldn't have freeloaders on this system. Maybe we really need to get people into the health insurance system.
And now it will be, with the president in the White House and Democrats in majority in the U.S. Senate. Joan Walsh, Charles Kessler, Jack Beattie, please stand by. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about election 2012 and what it means, what it tells us about the state, the spirit, the divide, the direction of the nation. Charles Kessler is with us from the conservative Claremont Institute, professor of government at Claremont McKenna College. Joan Walsh is with us, editor-at-large at Salon.com, our own Jack Beattie, and messages from early this morning, late last night, if you will. Here's Mitt Romney saying the nation is at a critical point, talking about working together.
We look to Democrats and Republicans in government at all levels to put the people before the politics. I believe in America. I believe in the people of America.
Put the people before the politics, if that's possible. Earlier this morning, the president celebrating his victory, saying Americans voted for action, not politics as usual.
In the coming weeks and months, I am looking forward to reaching out and working with leaders of both parties to meet the challenges we can only solve together. Reducing our deficit, reforming our tax code, fixing our immigration system, freeing ourselves from foreign oil. We've got more work to do.
There's no question it's a long list, and the president ticking it off there, ready to reach out, he says. But here's John Boehner, who will again be Speaker of the House, no doubt, speaking to a crowd of Republican supporters in Washington last night, called the House the primary line of defense, the GOP majority there, against government spending, called the reelected GOP majority itself a clear message from voters.
With this vote, the American people have also made clear that there's no mandate for raising tax rates. And what Americans want that are solutions that will ease the burdens on small businesses, bring jobs home, and let our economy grow. Listen, we stand ready to work with any willing partner, Democrat, Republican, or otherwise, who shares a commitment to getting those things done.
No mandate for raising tax rates. Hello, fiscal cliff. Hello, maybe division again. Let's go to our callers, Barbara in Mount Juliet, Tennessee. Barbara, thank you very much for calling. What do you see in your neighborhood, Barbara?
Well, I see some pretty rough stuff going on down here. I'm a lonely little Democrat in Tennessee.
And?
People are tearing Obama signs down. Sometimes they run over them with trucks. One guy built, I heard down here that he built a like an encasement, like a cage around his sign. They tore it down. You can't put up a sign in your yard for Obama. And if you say anything, you know, you have a right to say or speak. You're afraid somebody might trash your yard or throw an egg at your car.
So now, Barbara, we've got an outcome. President Obama's been reelected. Do you think that will change? Will it pull some of the sting, some of the furor, the fury out of that?
Well, the Republican has gone so radical, the Republican side, with his Tea Party. They don't even, they profess to be Christians, but they don't act like Christians anymore. They pick out verses from the Bible to suit their needs. And I'm a Christian myself. I'm a white grandmother. I have 9 grandchildren. And they just, I don't even go to church anymore. And I heard the other day that the church population is going down in America. Well, they need to rethink about, there's other people on the Democratic side that's just as Christian as they are, you know.
Barbara, we really appreciate your eye on the world there, and thank you for calling from Mount Juliet. Charles Kessler, what do you say to what you hear there? That kind of fury, is not the norm in a democracy outside the heat of an election, even in the heat of an election. What about the concern, and Barbara puts it well, that the GOP has become something more extreme than it ought to be or need to be?
Well, of course, incivility should be condemned on both sides. Here in California, you may in some parts of the state have the same problem protecting your Romney signs in your yard. And if you went to most of the Episcopal churches in Pasadena, for example, you'd find that they are extremely liberal in their theology. But that doesn't give you an excuse to be incivil or to attack someone's liberty or property, of course. But there are deep issues at stake here. And Jack brought up tax, spend, and elect. Tax and tax, spend and spend, and elect and elect.
Yep.
Harry Hopkins' old formula. The problem with the liberal agenda today is not in spending, or even as we saw last night in electing, it's in taxing. We're running $1 trillion annual deficits. And there's not enough money in the rich to pay for the programs that are underway or the new ones that are promised. And so we're really looking at higher tax rates for the middle class and for the country at large if we want to have as big and intrusive a welfare state as President Obama promises us. So he's going to run into very early in his term this problem that he's running these deficits. I think Obamacare will end up being another source of deficit spending. Ultimately, I disagree with Jack on that, and I think the CBO has really had been on both sides of that question. And I wouldn't be at all surprised to see things like the Medicaid extension, which is an important part of Obamacare, slowed up and drawn out and protracted because there just won't be enough money for all the social welfare programs if we add 40 million more people to Medicaid.
Let me go to Joan. Joan Walsh, where does this put us? Here we are, you know, 15 seconds after the result of this election, and you hear Barbara still calling in with that concern from her place in Tennessee and the fury thereabouts. Charles says no thank you to incivility, but wants to apportion it equally and sees as deep a divide as ever maybe on the fundament here of how we look at government and its role. Where do we go, Joan?
Well, I think we really have a problem when we are always going to this false equivalence that maybe if people are being, you know, having their Romney lawn signs taken down in California. I really submit that could have happened, but there is no comparison between the two parties. There is no Rush Limbaugh on the left. And what you've seen in the last 4 years, I mean, I give this country so much credit for electing Barack Obama, and I give white people credit for 43% of them back 4 years ago electing Barack Obama. But there's no, you cannot deny that it triggered an amazing backlash from people who do not want to face our multiracial future, and that it has triggered ugliness, and that you have seen the Republican Party aid and abet that kind of ugliness, double down on its whiteness, basically, allow the demonization of this president as somebody who wasn't born here, somebody who's a Muslim, somebody who doesn't believe in America when he's so American. And I think one way to get past this impasse is for the media to admit this is not an equal division of enmity and hate. It is coming from the right, and when Mitch McConnell stands up like he did last night and says this is not a mandate and this president has failed, he's playing to his right. He's afraid of a Tea Party challenge, but this is not a kind of two sides do it, because they don't.
Here was GOP strategist Steve Schmidt last night on NBC News saying the election should be a wake-up call to some elements in the GOP.
Conservatism shouldn't be defined by fidelity to all of these crazy statements by talk radio personalities or by reality show hosts who go out and say outrageous things. And when you have these reality show hosts like Donald Trump who are hanging around with our presidential candidates, and they are, by virtue of that, given some platform for seriousness, and they call for revolution on their Twitter accounts after the president has been legitimately reelected by the American people, it's got to be shut down by serious leaders in the Republican Party.
Republican strategist Steve Schmidt there last night on NBC. Jerry in Rocky Hill, Connecticut. Jerry, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Tom. Love your show.
Thank you. What do you see?
I'm a moderate Republican, and I got to tell you, I think the Republican Party's done. Unfortunately, I listen to Rush Limbaugh every day kind of religiously, and I got to tell you, the rhetoric that comes out of that guy's mouth makes me scared. It's a mess. I mean, the Republicans, we've got the Tea Party taking over. We're really going radical. And just like your caller said, it's just way too much hate on the Republican side.
But what about my guest Charles Kessler says it's not just about incivility. There's a difference in belief about what government should be, and it's a too big a gulf to straddle here. Do you see a room for compromise here, Jerry?
Not the way the Republican Party is now. That's why I think they're done. I think they don't want to move at all. I think this is what they believe in, and they don't want to touch it at all. That's why the Tea Party has taken such a foothold within the Republican Party. They still got some of their most radical people elected. I think last night, one of the guys that has gone on and said that the Democrats are like communists and stuff like that, he got elected last night. He didn't lose. See, I think they're still, winning some of these seats, and they've still got their foothold. And the Republican Party is struggling to deal with that because they don't know what they're doing. They don't know where they stand anymore. And I think a lot of earlier, a guy called in from the South, third-generation Republican, and he won't vote for them anymore. And it's the same problem with me. I can't see myself voting for Republicans anymore.
Jerry, I'll take it to Charles Kessler and Joan and Jack, but thanks for your call from Connecticut. One right here from Maine, South Portland, Maine. Frederick is calling. Frederick, you're on.
Hi, Tom and guests.
Hi.
I believe this election was about good governance and a fair share economy. Let's just take a quick trip back to look at the surplus that Bill Clinton had left this country. Through progressive taxation, that people would pay more if they had more.
Yep.
George Bush turned around, went into Iraq, and did not ask anyone to pay more for a war effort. This was the first time in the 20th century that we had run a massive war, created a massive deficit, and that really was government support for his cronies in the defense industry.
Well, I'm sure he would describe it differently, but you can't dispute that it did leave us with a deficit. So where are we now, Frederick?
Well, lastly, let's take that image of George Bush flying over Katrina and looking at the poor devastation in New Orleans. Let's fast forward now to good governance. And Barack Obama was on the ground embracing the Republican governor of New Jersey and the people on the ground in the devastated area of New Jersey and New York. We're talking about, if the Republican Party does not want to govern, then I say get out of the way.
Well, but they're a majority in the House. That's hardly out of the way. But, Frederick, I appreciate your call as well. Charles Kester, what about it? Our caller here, Frederick, you hear his good governance plea. Our caller, Jerry, moderate Republican, is worried the GOP is done if it doesn't change. I mean, we heard David Frum talking about this vote yesterday as a severe rebuke to the GOP. Where do you see change necessary, if anywhere, on the Republican perspective here, Charles?
Well, first of all, I mean, Frederick's comments recall the incredible hatred and distrust of George W. Bush just one administration ago. I mean, it's the things that Rush Limbaugh says about Barack Obama, I'm not sure would in any sense exceed what was said about George W. Bush.
Well, he complained about his policy about war and deficit.
MSNBC and elsewhere, yeah.
But I mean, war and deficit, our caller's complaining about, that seems fair game. He's asking for good governance. That doesn't seem over the top. But let's go to the situation now. We've had an election. We've had a vote, there were high hopes in the GOP, passionate hopes to take the White House. That's not there. What is the lesson? What is the change? Or is it dig in again, Charles?
Well, I think, I mean, the Bush presidency is a sort of undigested political fact for the Republican Party, too. One of the things that I think weakened Romney's candidacy was that he never really separated himself very much from the either the economics of the Bush administration or the foreign policy of the Bush administration, though it was clear he was politically allergic to both. And the party hasn't quite confronted, I think, the legacy of and the unpopularity of the Bush administration's policies. That's an intra-conservative argument to some extent, and I think that the argument going forward on the right is going to be not only about the failings of the Romney candidacy, but it's going to be about what the party has been doing at least since 2000, and that argument is not going to be one of about moderating conservative principles. It's going to be, I think, about defining conservative principles. Hostility to Hispanics is not, in my view at least, a conservative principle at all. The next generation, people like Marco Rubio, of politicians in the Republican Party, will to some extent be able to grapple with these issues much better than the current generation or the Romney generation. And so I think The prospects for the Republicans and for conservatives are going to look fairly sunny fairly soon, but the conservatives are not going to be interested in a compromise, which means asking us to give up our principles. And of course, no one is interested in such a compromise. But the problem is there are differences of principle which make compromises on many questions, though, as I said before, not all questions, very difficult.
And here we are in gridlock and divide, and Americans saying, you know, criminy, how do we get out of this? Jack, do you hear in that analysis a recipe for GOP comeback or compromise?
I think it's so hard for them to compromise on taxes. No Republican in either House of Congress has voted for a tax increase since 1990. Political scientists, there are papers showing that people who take the Grover Norquist no tax pledge are held accountable for that if they break the pledge, even by voters who want more taxes. That is to say, voters see that as breaking a promise. It is a kind of doomsday machine for the Republicans. And, you know, suppose you're a bold Republican and you say, I want a compromise. I want to increase taxes on the wealthy. To a certainty, you're going to be primaried. You can't ask politicians to commit Harry Caray like that. So I don't know whether that's a principle with them or political. I'm sure it's a principle. They don't want more taxes. But there's also just political fear. They don't dare do it. And so I don't see how the president gets a deal with them that involves his completing his promise of, yes, we're going to tax the rich. My view is he's got to let that go and hope, frankly, for economic growth to provide the impetus for the economy.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about election 2012 and what it means. It just went by. What it tells us, this Obama victory, about the state of what the spirit, the divide, the direction of the nation. Charles Kessler joins us from the Claremont Institute in Pasadena, California, with us today. Joan Walsh is here, editor-at-large at Salon.com. Our own Jack Beattie is here. The president, in his victory speech very early this morning in Chicago, talking a little grandly here, a euphoric crowd there, and the president really on late last night about the sometimes painful process of moving the country, his word, forward.
As it has for more than two centuries, progress will come in fits and starts. It's not always a straight line. It's not always a smooth path. By itself, the recognition that we have common hopes and dreams won't end all the gridlock or solve all our problems or substitute for the painstaking work of building consensus and making the difficult compromises needed to move this country forward.
Common hopes and dreams, compromises, the president said there. And the message was picked up around the country last night. Elizabeth Warren, Democrat, Massachusetts, beat incumbent Republican senator who had taken Ted Kennedy's old seat in a special election in the Tea Party year of 2010. Last night, Elizabeth Warren brought it back in the blue Democrat column. In her acceptance speech, she reached across the aisle rhetorically, appealing to Scott Brown voters.
I also want to speak tonight to Senator Brown's supporters. The message you sent was clear. We need leaders in Washington who are willing to break the partisan gridlock and work regardless of party. I know I didn't earn your vote, but I promise I'm going to work to earn your support.
Joan Walsh, do you see it? This space in which to break the willingness or space in which to break the partisan gridlock that Elizabeth Warren talks about there. The president talking about common hopes and dreams and compromise. Where's the room for that here, Joan?
I think it's very important that we look for common ground and that we talk about our common hopes and dreams because they are there. And I agree with the President, Tom, that our people are not as divided as our politicians. Having said that, though, I really think I don't want to revisit ancient history, but I had some reservations about candidate Barack Obama in 2007, 2008, because I thought he put too much trust in his own ability to compromise and to bring over Republicans. And I thought he did not quite get the extent to which Republicans went after somebody who may have been our best Republican president of my lifetime, Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton is somebody who reached to the center. Bill Clinton took Republican ideas about welfare reform and disappointed the left with them. Bill Clinton did what he did through the tax code. He expanded the earned income tax credit, a Milton Friedman idea. He used tax credits to expand access to college. Bill Clinton compromised and moved to the center, and he was impeached for his efforts. Barack Obama took office. I know that Charles may quibble with me on this, but when he approached the stimulus package, his first big job, he went out there with a package that was 40% tax cuts. Rather than waiting and compromising and saying, hey, Republicans, give me more spending and I'm going to give you these tax cuts, he went out there, reached across the aisle with a Republican idea and got zero votes in the House. So I think that paradoxically, I personally believe that the Democrats are going to help Republicans by refusing to compromise and by refusing to continue to move to the right and to stand up for the activist government that in the end Barack Obama stood up for and in the end got him reelected.
Jack, what do you think it's going to take? Activist government not looking so much for compromise? Compromise here? What does the GOP do? I mean, there was Mitch McConnell saying we're going to make this a one-term president by not giving Barack Obama successes. Well, now it's a two-term presidency. Does that work again in a second term?
You know, they've got to, I think as Charles said, they have to find a way around this this huge problem with the Hispanic vote. George W. Bush, 40% of it. McCain, 31%. Mitt Romney, 21%. That way lies defeat for the future, just given the bulge. So they have to deal with that. And people, the president said in his interview with the Des Moines Register that he thought that if he wins, he says, if I win, it'll be because largely this Hispanic Democratic vote in Colorado and Nevada and elsewhere. And I think that'll get the Republicans' attention. And we're going to go back to what George Bush and Karl Rove wanted to do, as we remember, in 2006, 2007, and have comprehensive immigration reform in which a path to citizenship is laid out for the 10 million undocumented workers. And if the Republic, you know, that would be a chance for a major, major bipartisan agreement, and it would allow the incubus of this Hispanic future to be lifted from the Republicans. Now, will they be able to do that? I just don't know. But, you know, you hear people like Lindsey Graham said, look, we just can't, you can't read these results and say, all we have to do is be more right-wing and we're going to win. He says, that's just putting your head in the sand. And I guess if his sort of voice, Senator McCain, others, perhaps they can work out something, a major deal on immigration.
But what about beyond immigration, beyond demographics, Jack? I mean, in a way, demographics are like ingredients on the kitchen countertop, right? But what are we going to bake with this? What kind of government? What profile? What do we do with the big problems in governability and you know, the size and how we pay for it? Do you see Joan Walsh's path there? Mr. President, don't be naive again. Don't walk back into that compromise cage. It doesn't. They won't play with you. Or do you see Barack Obama saying, we must, and here's how we will?
I think he wants to. I mean, I think he wants to compromise. And the deal that ended, you know, that was scuppered at the last minute with John Boehner, that would have made a lot of Democrats unhappy. You know, he was going to raise the age for Medicare eligibility in there. Boy, you know, tell that to a 64-year-old factory worker who just voted for the president.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the point is, he was ready to do that. And there's even been talk, and in the debate, first debate, he said, Governor Romney and I agree about Social Security. Well, a lot of Democrats were saying, why do you mean you agree about Social Security? The president has shown he's willing, at least to a certain extent, to defy his base and make a deal. Will he do that on some big, grand budget package? Who knows? But he has shown in the past that he's willing to at least consider it.
Charles Kessler, can Republicans be a bit more moderate and still be good conservatives by your yardstick? I mean, here's Kathy writes to us online. She says, Republicans prattle that America is a center-right country as if that were a holy mantra. They're right. Kathy says the problem is that Obama is center-right, in her view. The Democrats are center-right. The Republican Party's been hijacked by far-right extremists. America rejected that last night, our listener writes. Is there room here, Charles, for Republicans to come toward a center without betraying what you see as conservative principles?
Yes, I think there is on a number of questions. I think the immigration question, as Jack says, is one on which their self-interest is aligning with some kind of compromise position. And I don't think, I mean, since Marco Rubio is pro-DREAM Act or something like the DREAM Act, I don't think that the way forward to a compromise on that is necessarily that difficult. On other questions, it's harder to compromise. I mean, it's one thing to compromise with a president like Bill Clinton, who is really meeting you halfway and who is prepared to return welfare to the states to abolish one of the original New Deal era entitlements, AFDC, which he did back in the 90s, or to balance the budget by a combination of higher revenues coming in, small tax increases, and good economic times, I think mainly accounted for the fiscal probity of the 1990s.
Of course, taxes were much higher then than they were under George Bush or now.
Well, they were slightly, I mean, they were at 39% and change at the upper income tax level. And that's what Barack Obama is insisting on. That isn't, I wouldn't say that is socialism in any sense. And
so
I think
why has such a line in the sand been drawn there? Is that the Grover, just the Grover Norquist effect here? I mean, that's where I'm asking. If you see reasonable compromise, this is going to come up quick as an issue.
I think the reason the Republicans are reluctant to raise taxes is because they have been burned many times on the spending cut side. Reagan was burned. I mean, the sort of the lesson from the Reagan administration. Well, initially, he was going to have the Democrats promise $3 in spending cuts for every dollar of tax increases. He agreed to the tax increase. The spending cuts never happened, and I think Republicans are very wary being burned on that kind of a so-called compromise again. And this president, after all, is much, I would say, is a much more liberal president than Bill Clinton was, partly because Bill Clinton lost the battle for health care and he had to triangulate. And this president, President Obama, won his battle for health care and is still feeling his oats somewhat.
Well, Brad in Portland, Maine. Brad, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thanks, Tom. I'd like some – I actually see this election and actually the broader electorate is less about blue and red and more about the sort of demographics you were talking about earlier. And,
yep.
And I wanted to get some thoughts on the sort of long, steady and decline of the lower middle class and lesser educated white male. And that sort of ascendancy of the bitterness within that demographic is palpable among, you know, my neighbors and the people in my neighborhood. If they're a red state voter, they tend to be lesser educated. And this isn't a broad blanket statement, but it seems to me that they're, that the bitterness is about a lack of influence, and the rise of a more educated, in some cases, a more educated female electorate, a more independent female electorate. And it's nuanced and it's blurry.
Why do you have they turned red in your neighborhood, Brad? And why, if so?
Oh no! We're delayed. We passed yes on one in Maine yesterday, so we've got good reasons to celebrate on the liberal side. But I actually see, you know, more there's nobody who's going to find sympathy in the white American male, and I think there's frustration and anger among that group. And I think the Rush Limbaugh and the listeners for the Fox News type programs tend to be more firmly entrenched, and their bitterness is growing.
Brad, we're losing you, but we've got your point. Joan Walsh, what about it? President Obama, you know, not with the big showing among white voters, and you know very well the bitterness that our caller's talking about there. What does he do with that sector? Never mind Latinos for a minute, this sector in a second term.
Well, look, you know, I wrote a book about this, Tom, and I urge you. What's the matter with white people? But it's not an anti-white book, and I have a lot of sympathy. I mean, we're talking about a lot of my relatives out there, Tom, when we talk about the bitter white male. And I just want to point to one bright spot. The reason the president carried it, a year ago, I was pulling my hair out, but a year ago, David Plouffe and other people were talking about a path to 270 without Ohio or Wisconsin or Iowa because those white men, those non-college educated white men were too bitter, too angry, would never vote for him. Now, he didn't win that group, but he did do much better with them than he did in the rest of the country, and it is because of the auto restructuring. It is because he got tough on trade and China in ways that the rest of the country doesn't even understand that he did. So if you can speak to that group and if you can do something for that group, you may not win them over entirely, but you're going to do much better, and I think that's a lesson for the president, and that's a lesson for Democrats. Democrats did walk away from that group. They didn't walk away and go to women and minorities. They went and they walked away and they went to Wall Street and they stopped talking and they stopped making a difference in bread and butter ways for that constituency. On the other hand, that constituency has to decide, do you want to be part of the American future or do you not? Because there's a lot of racial fear and, you know, to some extent they're going to have to get over it or they're going to be miserable in this country in the years to come.
Paula in Bowling Green, Kentucky. Paula, thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking the call.
Yes.
Just a couple of things. I think the country last night in their voting did voice their opinion to the too far right of the Republican Party. The obstructionism, as a Kentuckian, I was quite embarrassed at Mitch McConnell when he first said his goal was to get Barack Obama out of office and have him a one-term president. Mm-hmm. I'm even still embarrassed that we carried the Republican vote in this state, that he's also back in that category. And I do think that the Republican Party will have to change. Some of their goals were to take women back to the 1950s on abortion reform, and I do think it's a woman's right to choose. I just don't think they can survive that way and ignore the 50% of the workforce that is women. And thirdly, everyone knows that a humane society is humane in how they treat their elderly and their disabled, their sick. And to see a gentleman say 47% of the people are on government programs or government welfare just irritates me to no end. The predominant amount of money spent is on the sick as well as veterans. than the elderly. So I'm looking forward to higher regulations on Wall Street. I'm looking forward to closing some of the tax loopholes and getting a fair amount of tax out there. When Warren Buffett pays a higher tax rate, or lower tax rate, excuse me, than his secretary, something's wrong with
Paula, it. Paula, we've got it, and I appreciate your call. Get one more here. Thank you so much, Paula. Linda, Nolensville, Tennessee. Linda, you're on.
I thank you so very much for all this insight regarding our political system.
Mm-hmm.
But because there's so much turmoil on Main Street, believing that our needs are still not addressed as a whole, how does the voting public make sure that the Democrats and Republicans work together this next 4 years? Do we march at our Capitol at each state? Does anybody have any suggestions?
Linda, that's a good and straightforward and relevant question right now. Joan Walsh, what do you say? Linda wants the parties to work together and work things out. What about it?
I think most people do. And you know, I go back to our caller who said he's a moderate Republican and he can't vote for this party anymore. I would just urge moderate Republicans not to vote for this party anymore. They have to be taught a lesson. The challenges cannot only come from the Tea Party right. The challenges need to start coming from the moderate, from the center Republicans standing up to the Tea Party right. I think that's the way it has to start.
Charles, Lindsey Graham is kind of talking that way just in the last 24 hours. Do you expect to see more of that kind of tone out of the GOP?
Well, the GOP will be chastened to some extent, and therefore you will hear more of what Lindsey Graham is saying. But on the other hand, I mean, the most conservative part of the National Party in the House of Representatives was returned to office. So until unless the electorate votes more consistently, I don't think you can blame Republicans for doing what they said they were going to do in their campaigns.
Jack, do you see some light here to aim toward in these? I mean, there's a victory. It's clear. That's a light for the president. What about Linda on Main Street saying, do you guys get together or not?
I think we muddle through. and we hope that if we go over the fiscal cliff, we quickly recover. And that the Republicans recognize that they do have to shift to survive, and that self-interest reassert itself here.
Well, the election speaks. It has consequences. The first one, President Obama back in the White House, and we will watch more from there. Joan Walsh with Salon.com, editor-at-large there. Joan, always great to have you. Thank you for being here on this day.
Thank you, Tom.
Charles Kessler at Claremont Institute, thank you so much for joining us, Charles.
Thank you very much.
Jack, thanks as always. Here we go. Jack, one more time.
Thank you.
This is On Point.